Just gone 1 o'clock on a Tuesday. That means it's time for the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. We've got a full house in the studio today. We've got Andrea Teagle from the Daily Maverick and assistant editor First Thing. We've got John Stupart, editor at First Thing. Welcome, John.
Hi.
And we've got Greg Nicholson. I'm not quite sure what to call you, Greg. You don't really have a beat. Maverick of Daily Maverick journos, I guess, all over the place from... from the Oscar trial to Murray Connor to a bit of everything.
Just keep talking.
There you go. And we've got a special guest with us today, the Managing Director of EE Publishers, Chris Yelland. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, guys.
I'm your host, Silly Sharalambus. As usual, we'll go through some of the big issues in the First Thing Daily newsletter. You can get that at Daily Maverick from the Daily Maverick website or on Cliff Central under the Daily Dose banner. And we turn to John and Andrea to tell us what were the big stories that we covered in the newsletter today.
Okay, well, I mean, firstly is the Badgers, the poor, horrible Badgers who had to be culled. No, not really. I mean, that was the sort of the last story. I think Burkina Faso, absolutely, still a big story. Started this, you know, with the whole destabilization of the government, and now we see the military taking power. They've been given an ultimatum by the African Union, which I think is normal procedure for the African Union, given its stance on illegal transitions of power.
So we had a people's revolution that took place, when was it, Friday?
Yeah, well, and I mean, Simon Allison actually had a thing on Daily Maverick talking about how we shouldn't get too excited about it, you know, having the flavors of Che Guevara and Fidel Castro, because this does look like it could be a long-term thing, which also has implications for the African Union, who is now starting, ironically, a new Zuma-based security force called the African Capacity for Immediate Response to Crises, or ASIC, which is supposed to be this hybrid intervention force. Now, if this turns ugly, this could be the first prototype mission next year, possibly. I mean, nothing's been announced, and I think it's a long way off from that. But if that happens, I think we're in for very, very interesting times in about January, February next year.
I think Simon made that point in his article. He said, you know, while people's revolutions might be great, if we look to what happened in Egypt with the Arab Spring, what happens afterwards is what really counts. Mm. And you end up in a situation where you're almost as worse off, or as worse off as you were before the revolution happened. So, you know, hence the stance from the African Union, not really to get behind the support. And you've got military intervention now, and you know, sort of factions within the military, they're looking to stake claim for leadership in Burkina Faso.
Yeah, it's sadly quite the norm, I suppose, for Africa's historical precedents for unlawful changes in government. I dare say not even Africa, just around the world in general. It's a sad reflection. That said, you know, there is a possibility, and it's always a slight possibility, that they go the way of Brazil, where, okay, you clamp down on civil society and folks like us would probably be dragged into the street and shot, but the economy and general development actually goes through quite well by using technocrats and things like that.
Well, you might be shot, but I don't think anyone would shoot Andrea, because she's too pretty for that. Andrea, you had an interesting fact for us today.
Yeah, I have a couple of twinsy facts for us. To do with identical twins, having met a few who really didn't strike me as particularly identical, I found that firstly, identical twins don't have identical fingerprints, which is pretty weird. Even though when they're first developing in the womb, they are identical, they after a while start touching things and moving around, and this results in different ridges developing on their hands, and they have unique fingerprints.
So they can't commit a crime and blame the other guy.
Yeah, I was thinking it's just as well, you know, in case the one decides to.
And can we still call them identical?
Well, actually, though, the differences are much more extensive than just their fingerprints.
Okay.
Even though they have exactly the same DNA, as they start progressing, a lot of people notice that twins become quite different as they grow up. And part of the reason for this is that individual and environmental experiences actually impact the chemicals which determine which genes are switched on and which are switched off and how they behave, you know, leaving an actual imprint on the genetic makeup of the twins. And, yeah, this can lead to quite distinct personality traits and interests, which is pretty interesting. And even, you know, some genetic, epigenetic markers like this can be passed through generations in very specific circumstances.
That's quite useful if you, I mean, that whole nature versus nurture debate always crops up at parties, and it's a nice way to sound, you know, at least partially informed about the whole thing, to talk about the nurture side of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
And, you know, even if they're reared in exactly the same way, they're bound to have individual, you know, differences and experiences, which definitely will result in epigenetic differences. Yeah.
This reminds me a little bit of that book that we recommended that Rebecca Davis was busy reading.
Yeah, this actually sparked my interest and you know, it was so about these Welsh twins who were
Give us the very brief summary.
I can't actually remember their names, which I feel like is throwing this a little bit, but these girls grew up, they were quite peculiar. They were very, very engrossed in their own world, didn't communicate with anybody else, which apparently is not actually unusual. A lot of twins have their own language. Anyhow, it sort of got worse as they grew older. And when they got to about 18, they staged a whole lot of petty crimes and ended up in a mental institution where I think we actually spoke about this on the radio show before. The one informed the doctor in the car that in order for them to be free, one of them was going to have to die, and they decided amongst themselves that she was going to be that one. And she proceeded to have a strange heart attack or something completely unexplained and died on her sister's shoulders. And yeah, very, very odd story indeed. So, yeah. Twins, always interesting.
Yeah, always interesting. John, you've got another fact that was in today's newsletter.
Yes,
an interesting fact about nuclear energy.
Yeah, and ironically, as I was writing this, the power went off and I had to switch to my laptop.
The irony that is.
So I was just looking at facts to do with nuclear power, given the whole exploration, at least, of development of nuclear power in South Africa, and looking at job creation for the construction of just an average nuclear power facility, and according to what I found, it looked like it would generate between 1,400 and 3,500 jobs for the construction of the nuclear power plant to begin with, and then it'll retain about 400 to 700 workers on a permanent basis. And then also, if it matters and you're working in the energy sector, you tend to earn 36% to 44% more in your salary on your paycheck than the average sort of wage earning person in your area. I suspect that'll probably be higher in South Africa as well, given where these plants are supposed to be built, which is, I think, far up near Botswana, if I remember correctly. So it was just very, very interesting to see that the job creation part of it, quite interesting. Oh, and that the nuclear power apparently powers the Mars rovers, although I did receive an email today from a very, very upset reader pointing out that solar power indeed actually powers most of it, and nuclear power only sort of keeps it warm at night, still powers it.
Nuclear does power attack submarines, nuclear attack submarines. So, it can be used for peaceful and non-peaceful purposes. Yeah.
And aircraft carriers as well. Mm-hmm. You have giant reactors there. You have entire sort of, have about 100 sailors just sitting in the bowels of an aircraft carrier maintaining this nuclear reactor.
And did you know that at one point the U.S. was considering seriously developing a nuclear-powered aircraft? Now, can you imagine an aircraft accident?
Now that we're on the topic, I read something yesterday from one of the military sites that I read, and the U.S. military is actually exploring the development of nuclear batteries.
For iPhone users.
it can only make them smarter, really. But the nuclear batteries themselves would actually power things like, your mobile radar systems. Radios would last indefinitely, I would say. But there's a problem with apparently leakage, which I imagine is a problem with nuclear batteries.
And most things. John, just on that and feedback from First Thing Readers, one day we're going to publish a book called Shit First Thing Readers Say in emails that you get. And we'll talk about those crazy emails you guys get in response. But I guess if you are mailing out to 70,000 people on a daily basis, chances are you're going to hit a couple of crazies along the way. So there's a reason we're talking nuclear as well. Last week, Thursday, EE Publishers, of which Chris Yelland is the managing director, and Daily Maverick held a debate on nuclear energy. I attended that, and Chris was there as well to host the debate. We had some very interesting speakers there. I must say I really enjoyed attending the debate, and we should look to try and have a whole lot more of those. But Chris, maybe you can take us through some of the highlights, where people can get some of the coverage and some of the articles and material from there, and also your take on the nuclear energy debate.
Well, we had about 230 people at the debate. It was an open public debate hosted by EE Publishers and Daily Maverick. We had four really good speakers, I thought. Ambassador Mbongo from NECSA, the Nuclear Energy Corporation of South Africa, speaking really as a pro-nuclear position. And he was actually in Russia with the Minister of Energy when the Nuclear Cooperation Agreement, or whether it was a done deal or not, we still don't quite know. But he was in Russia with the minister when that agreement was signed. Apparently he had to leave the room when it was actually signed by the minister and the Russians. So perhaps he hasn't actually seen the full details. I'm still not sure on that. But he was one of our speakers. The other one was a guy called Des Muller from Group 5 Nuclear Projects. They are in the nuclear construction business. Opposing nuclear was Dirk de Vos, a writer for Daily Maverick and also writes for EE Publishers on occasion. Mr. Grevier Steyn, Dr. Grevier Steyn, an economist. So we had really interesting group of speakers arguing the case. Three motions were put to the vote. The first motion was that we should stop nuclear energy in South Africa, or the nuclear new build program in South Africa, forthwith, and because it's really not appropriate for South Africa. That was the sort of extreme position on the left, you might say. In the middle was, hang on, we must not proceed with the nuclear new build. We need to do more homework. We need to study the economics, the financial implications. Can we afford it? We haven't done our homework correctly. In the meantime, we need to study these things before we make a final decision on whether or not to proceed. And then the extreme position, perhaps you can say on the right, was we've done our homework. Let's proceed with the nuclear new build program following a clean, open, transparent, competitive bidding process as required by the Constitution and the Public Finance Management Act. We should go ahead with this. And this was put to the vote, and I thought the outcome was quite interesting.
Which was?
Well, certainly the motion number three, which is that we should proceed, received more votes than the other individual motions. But I must stress that the audience was quite heavily dominated by NECSA people, and also by ESCOM people, and certainly by engineering people. And you know, engineers, they love challenge, they love big projects.
It's like having generals vote on whether to have another defense deal.
Yeah, so the audience was quite heavily, I would say, industry orientated. Mm. And yet the outcome was interesting for me, because if you were to look at the number of people who voted for motion number one, which is stop nuclear now, and you look at motion number two, which was do not proceed with nuclear new build program because we haven't done the homework yet. If you add the two together, so the people who voted for either motion number one or motion number two were in fact the majority, and the people who voted that we've done our homework, let's proceed now following a clean, open, competitive process, was in fact a minority position if you were to compare it to motion number one or two. So, and bearing in mind that this is an industry-dominated audience of an engineering sort of scientific kind, I would say that in general, if you were to extrapolate this, and remember, this is a very informed audience. They've just heard four information-rich presentations, and that's the way they voted. So if I were to extrapolate this, I would say that South Africa is not ready to embark on the nuclear new build program now. But that's just my analysis, and I am extrapolating, and we can't really judge the wider South African view from an audience of only 230 people.
But the challenge is that we have energy and severe energy demands right now. So to delay the process, or to delay remedying or attempting to remedy the process, is only going to cause us much more heartache down the line. I mean, Greg, you've been following the tribulations at ESCOM's plant with the problems with the silo. You know, give us a little bit more background to what's going on there.
I think Chris would probably be the person to really give the deepest background there. But I think sort of one of the most interesting things there we've seen. We saw the Solidarity Union Solidarity statements that there's this silo, one of three coal silos that holds 10,000 tons of coal, develop a crack on Saturday. I think it was about 12:30. Within 40 minutes, that crack had spread and the thing collapsed, causing sort of a stoppage and a huge sort of cuts in the capacity of the station out in Mpumalanga. And since then, we've seen sort of follow on. On Sunday we had power cuts across the country, but it was load shedding to sort of prepare the country for the week ahead, and we could see more sort of load shedding as the week goes on. But I think one of the biggest things coming back to what you were talking about is how do we sort of meet the short-term energy sort of needs and requirements? I'm not sure how we can do it, but try to make sure we have all these power stations operating at their best and the maintenance programs running smoothly. But I think Chris would be able to elaborate on that a lot more.
Yeah, I think you're right. There are no short-term solutions to increasing the supply of generation capacity because everything that can be done in this regard is being done. The short-term solution really involves improving the performance of Eskom's existing generation fleet, which is performing extremely poorly. The energy availability factor, which is a measure of the availability of Eskom's existing fleet of power stations, has declined from 85% to 75%, effectively taking off the grid about 4,000 megawatts, simply due to poor performance and regular unplanned outages of Eskom's existing fleet. And that is the problem in the short term. We need to get that energy availability factor back up to 85%. This would bring on another 4,000 megawatts onto the grid that is already constructed. So that is the short-term option. The other short-term option, of course, is to manage demand for electricity. But I must tell you that South Africa's electricity consumption at the moment is at a seven-year low. The annual consumption in 2013, ending April 2014, is a seven-year low. So this has been caused by, of course, supply constraints by Eskom, number one. Number two, Eskom's very effective marketing campaign not to use its product is paying off, and people are not using its product.
And also, if we want to grow as an economy, surely we need to be using more electricity in order to create, you know.
Absolutely. If you want to grow your economy, you have to increase the supply of electricity because electricity is the engine of the economy. And one can tighten one's belt and use less electricity. You can also turn away investors who look at South Africa and decide that this is not the right place to invest because of the security of supply situation cannot be guaranteed, and the future trajectory of the electricity price seems very disturbing. So this uncertainty, you know, is a result of the growth forecast in South Africa being downgraded from 4% projected growth to recently has been downgraded to 1.5% per annum. Combination of a number of factors, but certainly the supply of electricity and Eskom's marketing campaign and investors walking away is the kind of reason why growth is not as expected.
And with more load shedding and more energy problems set to come, that's only going to affect our growth rate even more and our ratings.
And I must say, there's a negative cycle. The less electricity you use in South Africa, the higher the price of electricity becomes. It seems astounding, but that's the fact, because there are fixed costs. Eskom has to recover a certain amount of revenue on the base of a certain amount of kilowatt hours units sold. So if you sell less kilowatt hours to recover the same amount of money, you need to have a higher price per kilowatt hour. And that's an upward pressure on the price, and an upward pressure on the price puts further downward pressure on consumption. And you get into this negative cycle, which we somehow have to break out of through the increased supply of electricity, part of which has got to come by increasing the performance of the current power stations that are in South Africa.
I'd like to get back to the nuclear debate, because I think it's a very important part of the energy mix and South Africa and the existing one, and obviously going forward, it does have a role to play, whether that's third or fourth generation. That's the question. But just, you know, ending off on the current crisis at the silo in Mpumalanga, you know, we've got on the one hand Eskom saying this is like a one in a million thing that's happened, the silos collapse, and then on the other hand you've got Solidarity saying the other. You know, do we need to take what Eskom is saying and pull that through a bullshit filter, or do we look at what Solidarity are saying and saying, well, hang on a second, have they actually been lying to us?
Look, we do have to be careful on the information that's been given out by Eskom. Remember in 2008, on national TV, on carte blanche, they asked the question, you know, are you running out of coal in your power stations? And Dr. Steve Lennon said, no, definitely not. You know, other problems. And then carte blanche switched over to helicopters flying over the coal stockyards, showing that the coal stockyards were empty. And they took an online poll, an SMS poll, and it turned out to be the biggest online SMS poll in South Africa's history at that date. And by far the majority of the people who responded, because the question was, do you believe Eskom? And the answer was no. So, and you know, just recently they issued a press release at 11 o'clock at night on Saturday evening after you know, 10 hours after the collapse of the silo, they issued a press release saying that there was a crack in the silo, and no mention was made in the fact that the silo had collapsed. So we do have to be careful. Now, Solidarity has come out with a statement that Eskom knew all about the problems on this central silo that was suffering from vibration caused by the conveyors which are mounted on top of the silo. So that silo has a dual function. It receives coal from the conveyors, but it also supports a total of 4 conveyors. Now, when these conveyors run and operate, it causes vibration, and Solidarity says the vibration was too high. They've been monitoring the vibration since January 2014, and they say they're hiding it. I asked Eskom. Eskom deny this completely. They say that Solidarity is confusing the matter. There was another silo that was taken out of service at Medupi a year ago, and that they're getting confused between the two. I went back to Solidarity, who assure me that they are not confused. They know very well the difference between the problematic silo a year ago, which happened to be the coal stockyard silo, and the central silo that collapsed on Saturday, and they say that the vibration was on the central silo. We don't know the outcome about who's telling the truth, and time will tell. But I think one does have to be cautious about all information received to make sure it's credible.
So in this nuclear debate that we hosted last Thursday, I think a couple of interesting things came up, came out of the discussions for me. And the one is that, which seemed sort of a little bit silly, but relevant though, is because when you say the word nuclear, you think bombs and you think, you know, disasters, and you think only really bad things, when in actual fact nuclear as an energy source isn't, you know, is cleaner than a lot of the other energy sources that we're currently using in South Africa at the moment.
Well, I don't think we can be against nuclear on principle, because the sun, solar energy, the stuff we get from these solar plants, PV, that is a nuclear reaction. In the sun, nuclear fusion is generating all the energy that we enjoy every day in sunlight. So we cannot be against nuclear in principle, but we can be against it in practice. And there one has to look at rational argument and not emotional, faith-based belief systems. We need to look at this matter rationally from an engineering and scientific perspective. And you're right, nuclear energy has numerous advantages, and it also has certain disadvantages. And one's got to look at the application, about where you put it, where is it best suited. So, for example, nuclear is very appropriate in a coastal environment, which is close to the sea, because you need vast amounts of seawater for cooling purposes. It's certainly not suitable for Gauteng or Limpopo, or areas where there is a shortage of water. It's also very suitable for areas that are a long way away from South Africa's current generation sources, which are dominated by up in the north here, in Mpumalanga and Limpopo, and load centers like Durban or KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, around Port Elizabeth, in Cape Town itself, are really good sites for a nuclear, because they are far away from the load centers. They need local generation. They're close to the sea. They have sea water. It's absolutely inappropriate to transport vast amount of coal down from the north of South Africa down to the coast. The cost of transport is astronomical, and would make a coal-fired power station totally uneconomical. So in those environments, nuclear becomes an economically viable option, and certainly will help in terms of reducing CO2 emissions. It has disadvantages of high-level nuclear waste, but these things can and are being dealt with in many other countries of the world.
I mean, we've had Cuba running for 30 years now. Is it 30 years that's been running?
Yes, and it's far more dangerous driving to work and from work at Cuba than it is working for a generation at the nuclear site. In other words, what I'm really saying is, when you're talking about risks and safety and things like that, we take risks that are very, very, very much higher than working in a nuclear power station. We take them every day when we drive our cars. And so one has to look at this rationally and say that, in fact, if you were to look at the number of people that are killed per gigawatt hour of electricity generated by that technology, nuclear energy is by far the safest of all energy sources. And that considers the end-to-end use of this production of this energy, from mining through to delivery of the electricity out of the power station. Nuclear energy has a proud safety record, despite Chernobyl, despite Three Mile Island, despite Fukushima.
Which we can really think a tidal wave for. I'm not, you know, that kind of...
Look, nature is not benign. Nature is very dangerous. Solar power is not benign. Today it was reported that a number of people have died on a solar power plant because a crane collapsed. And that would count towards the number of deaths per gigawatt hour of electricity generated by solar. So, you know, we have to look at this rationally. And if you look at nuclear energy in South Africa and abroad, well, I mean, South Africa, I don't know of a single death by radiation in South Africa over the last, since it was introduced. I'm not aware of it myself.
I feel that before... So before we even discuss all the risks, the risks and the benefits, the advantages and the disadvantages, in South Africa we're still caught up in the problem of and whether nuclear energy is suitable for the country going forward, because this is going to be such a huge cost to the country, we're talking about big money here, and there's the potential of corrupt deals being done. I feel that that's sort of blocking us from discussing this thing rationally before we actually discuss nuclear suitability. Because we don't really trust the government, and President Zuma seems to have taken quite a strong lead on this on this issue. How do you feel that that political situation and our lack of faith in our political leaders is holding up this actually looking at how feasible this is and having a real conversation going forward about whether we want nuclear energy or not?
No doubt, the trust levels of the public in the procurement processes of government are very low. From e-tolls to the arms deal through to Inkandla, these are all signals that the procurement processes are not up to scratch. But let us just put that aside for the moment, and let us just look at it, assuming that there was an adequate procurement process. I still don't think it's a clear-cut answer, because one of the problems with nuclear is that this is large baseload power stations is very inflexible, and we're living in a very dynamic and fast-changing and uncertain world. So if you look at the Integrated Resource Plan for Electricity, which is a 20-year plan, if you look at the projections for growth on which that plan is based, you have the high road, the medium road, the low road. Well, the consumption of electricity in South Africa is way below the low road for the first 3 years. And if you get your projections wrong in the first 3 years, the impact in 20 years' time can be an error of 50, 60, 70% error in the amount of generation capacity you build. We need to be flexible in whatever plan we have. We need to adapt. We've seen growth projections in South Africa decline from 5% to 1%, you know, in a very short space of time. And this is the reality of the world we live in. So we have to embark on whatever we do, has to take into account the reality of the need to be flexible, and nuclear is certainly one of the least flexible of all technologies.
Wouldn't it be more flexible for us to have an oversupply? Because we'd be able to supply the rest of the region and maybe even other parts of Africa with that. So, I mean, isn't it better to err on the side of having more than having less,
well,
which is the current
to
current
answer
problem.
That question, firstly, the demand for electricity by our neighbors is very, very low compared to South Africa's demand for electricity. You know, Botswana has got a demand of about 600 megawatts. The whole of South Africa is 40,000 megawatts. So just to put it, and Zimbabwe, Namibia, Lesotho, Swaziland, Mozambique are no different. So our neighbors' electricity consumption is very, very low indeed. Should we have an oversupply of capacity? Well, it's very, very expensive. If you have generation capacity that you have to pay for, and it's not producing electricity, you have stranded assets, the cost of electricity can skyrocket, as it did in the past when we had a 40% surplus of electricity. There was a commission of inquiry. You guys are too young to even remember this. We had a 40% excess supply of electricity. We had a commission of inquiry which basically got rid of Eskom's management, put in new brooders into the job, who reduced the staff of Eskom from 60,000 to 30,000.
No, that was in the 80s, right?
Somewhere around there, yeah. 80s, yeah. John Marie. Was brought in as an industrialist to come and sort Eskom out, because as far as they were concerned, it was out of control.
So the question of inflexible mega projects versus this dynamic economic environment that we work in was obviously what Dr. Crevier was one of the points that he raised at the debate. But some of the other interesting bits that came out was that France currently has the lowest cost of electricity in Europe, and that's mostly powered by nuclear. Mm. And Germany, which to its credit has 10% of its energy mix is driven by renewables, has the most expensive energy in Europe. So you still have this very much fixed cost up front for nuclear, mm-hmm. and then a lower, more manageable variable cost of the product coming out afterwards.
And if you were to ask, what is the producer of the cheapest power in electricity? What power station in South Africa produces the cheapest electricity? Many people will be surprised to know that it's Coburg Power Station, mm-hmm. the nuclear power station, which by far produces the cheapest electricity in South Africa because the capital cost is paid off. There's no more debt on Coburg. Mm. The running costs, the fuel costs are extremely low. The maintenance costs are extremely low. And therefore, you're kind of printing money. So once it's paid off, it becomes a very cheap producer of electricity. But of course, to build it now, the capital cost is very high. But if you were to look at the price trajectory of coal over the next 20 years, which, by the way, we have no idea what the price is going to be of coal in 20 years. But I want to tell you, if it's going up at the rate it's going up at the moment, coal could be the most expensive form of electricity in 20 years.
And the dirtiest.
And of course, the dirtiest and the most CO2 emissions, the highest health effects, more deaths per kilowatt hour or megawatt hour of electricity than many silos that collapse, you name it. So we mustn't just assume that what is a low-cost producer of electricity now is going to be a low-cost of electricity in 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, because a coal power station is designed to last for 50 years. Mm. A nuclear power station lasts for 60-plus years. A renewable energy system is typically designed to last for 20 years. So you would have to build three of these renewable energy plants in the same period that you would have to build one nuclear power station.
But then what of carbon capturing techniques and things like that? I know at the moment, if I remember correctly, it was something like it reduces efficiency of your average coal power plant by about 25%, excuse me, if you implement a carbon capturing sort of technology on your coal power plant. But apparently in the States they're developing new technology that might actually sort of negate any deficiency in production or output of power. Do you think South Africa would even consider that?
Well, certainly both Medupi and Kusile power stations are being made to be ready for carbon capture and storage. The plant is designed to have this technology in the future if they find the money to do it. And if it becomes something that needs to be done in terms of our reduction of CO2 emissions. So, we're building these high CO2 emission power stations, and we have to think about the future, about what could be the pressures that come on South Africa to reduce its carbon emissions, including economic pressure. Mm. That if you do not do this, you will suffer economic consequences. We have to take this into account. That's why, for example, flue gas desulfurization is being installed at Kusile and at Medupi. They're not installing it, but they have committed to the World Bank in terms of a World Bank loan that they will install it in due course when the power station is complete and the power station is being designed for this technology when it's complete. So we have to take into account and be flexible enough to adapt to these. But I wouldn't write off nuclear on flexibility grounds because you can build a nuclear program without committing to 9,600 megawatts with the Russians in one order. Coburg was designed to have six reactors, but they only placed the order for two reactors. And that's what they built, and they stopped after two reactors because South Africa had a surplus of generation capacity. Had we signed up for all six reactors, it would have had disastrous consequences on the cost of electricity. So it's really important, I believe, not to sign a contract with the Russians or with the French or the Americans, to commit ourselves to six or nine or whatever number of reactors and lock ourselves for the next 50 years, no way out, and we get these reactors whether we want them or not. We have to procure in a flexible way, and I believe Coburg has shown that we can do this. And not only that, if you progressively build reactors, you get to know which suppliers you can rely on, and maybe you shouldn't place the next order with them. You get revenue from the one reactor in order to help finance the second one and the third one. So far better to build this on a progressive step-by-step basis than on a big bang approach and place one order with one supplier.
Another thing that came up was the discussion around fourth generation nuclear power, which the Chinese are busy finalizing or getting to a commercially ready state. What's the difference between the fourth and the third generation? So the ones like Kuburg is what we would classify as third generation now. The dinosaurs.
Kuburg is a second generation reactor. The third generation reactors are really new on the market. There are some under construction, but there are none that have been completed yet. And these are really, as was described in the debate by one presenter, Javier Steyn, these are massive.
Dinosaurs.
He called them dinosaurs or monsters. These are the third generation reactors. These are the most inflexible one. The fourth generation reactors will be modular, will be smaller reactors, perhaps thorium reactors, which reprocess fuel from conventional reactors into a much safer form of nuclear fuel. And in other words, using the high-level waste spent fuel from existing power stations to power safer reactors, which have even safer waste products. So this is the future. But you know, it's like your iPhone. Do you buy the phone now, or do you wait for the next model that is coming out in 6 months' time? And if you wait for the next model in 6 months' time, there's going to be another model coming out which is even better. And you're kind of always deciding, you know, when am I going to do it? And ultimately, you know, there's always something better on the horizon.
Chris, I'd like to wrap up the discussion on that. I mean, maybe give us your thoughts on you know, what is the short-term solution? And where can we find you know, the material from the debate if people want to look up what happened?
For South Africa, I believe we need two strategies. Number one, we need to diversify away from our overdependence on coal as a primary energy source. It's very risky to generate 90% of your electricity from one energy source. We need all forms of energy, wind, solar, nuclear, hydro, gas, coal, you name it. They are all part of the solution. They all have advantages and disadvantages. And the more you can have a diversified portfolio of energy, primary energy sources, the better you are in terms of risk. It's like having a balanced portfolio and a share portfolio. On the second thing, I believe we need to diversify away from a heavy overdependence on Eskom as a monopoly electricity supplier. We need to introduce alternatives in order to manage risk. We cannot be in the hands of one a supplier that's in financial difficulty, that's having technical problems. We need to have a competitive energy environment where we can benchmark different generators and that their prices cannot simply be passed through to the customer ad infinitum. We need to have a competitive market, in my opinion. In terms of the supply of electricity in the short term, we need to improve Eskom's energy availability factor. Bring it up from 75% to 85%. That can be done in the relative short term and will add another 4,000 megawatts onto the grid.
How can that be done in the short term? Yeah.
Well, Eskom have taken on a new guy called Mike Rousseau. He comes from was a director of Xstrata, which, as you know, was bought by Glencore. He comes from a mining and industrial background. He was the chairman of the Energy Intensive User Group. He'd been brought in as a Mr. Fix-It to look at this. You know, Eskom perhaps have got tunnel vision in the sense that they've been doing things in a certain way for a long time, and they need new views on the matter, and they brought this guy in to actually help Eskom look at this energy availability factor and do something about it. Let's hope he can do something about it. But that is what has to be done. It needs to have a new maintenance regime, because the decline in the energy availability factor is because Eskom have been deferring maintenance instead of doing it by the book. In other words, they've been trying to keep the lights on at all costs, but the cost of keeping the lights on is now coming back to hurt us because these units that have deferred maintenance are now failing and are getting unplanned maintenance. So step one, bring up improve the energy availability factor. Step two, get Medupi and Kusile finished. That's another 9,000 megawatts of generation capacity that can come on stream, plus the 4,000 from the energy availability factor. You know, that's bringing on 14,000 megawatts. Mm. This is like 30-40% of South Africa's existing capacity. That's what we got to do, and we got to do it fast.
And the 1,000 from Angola as well.
Yes, and Angola, and we've got to bring on new renewable energy sources, and we've got to look at gas, and we've got to look at nuclear, and all these different options. You know, we have an energy-rich environment in South Africa. We do not have an energy problem. We have a management problem.
But I guess sums up the troubles, the energy troubles in South Africa. Greg, you've been following another story with the Treatment Action Campaign, following the plight of these guys to raise enough funding. The Treatment Action Campaign, obviously famous for being the driving force behind the government's adoption of antiretroviral drugs for HIV-positive patients and making a severe dent into the number of deaths in this country under the denialist era of the Mbeki government. How is it going for them? I know they had a very important press conference that was going on today. What's the latest on that?
So essentially the Treatment Action Campaign has a funding crisis. To operate for the 2015-2016 year, they need to raise 35 million. Well, they need a total operating budget of 35 million rand. And I think currently they have 7 million. So they've been going on a fundraising drive. And today they had Archbishop Desmond Tutu come out in support and to sort of say, please, can you donate? Because if we lose the Treatment Action Campaign, this is the argument, we will lose lives. So they're aiming to raise 10 million rand in November, that's their sort of first target, which I think they really, really need to keep the organization running. On the weekend, they ran the Soweto Marathon. There was a bunch of TAC members as well as activists that support their cause who ran with banners and flags and things like that. And you could sponsor T-shirts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You could sponsor either a runner or just sort of donate for that. And they had quite well-known HIV activists also living with HIV who ran the 10 kilometer, the half marathon or the full marathon. And throughout the month, they're having different events just like this, sort of getting different people to come and support them and to speak about their successes and the importance of having TAC around. And the whole month-long of campaigning will culminate in an event on World AIDS Day, December 1st, where instead of going to the government, the official World AIDS Day meeting, I think, which is in Bloemfontein, they're going to have their own one in Bloemfontein, Johannesburg, where they'll have a number of speakers just to talk about the importance of the TAC and the ongoing struggle to improve the healthcare system and, in particular, improve access to antiretroviral drugs and monitor people on ARVs, improve access to TB medicine and testing and other causes.
A part of the problem sounds like people think that the HIV AIDS problem has been sorted. You know, ARVs are now available through government hospitals, and basically the job for the TAC is done. But if we look at the number of people that are still dying from HIV, and again coming back to the management of government resources and services, it's still far from over. The TAC still has a lot of work to do.
Well, I think one of the things the TAC has realised from this, and one of its directors, Mark Haywood, who's also with Section 27, has spoken about it quite a few times, where he's realised now that relying on foreign funding for these things, for ongoing funding of an NGO, isn't necessarily sustainable. Because what happened essentially is the TAC, like a lot of other organizations around the country, and there are a lot of organizations going through the same thing, because what happened was when at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, when Thabo Mbeki was, you know, throwing out all these different theories about the link between HIV and AIDS, and we were hearing all these different alternative cures, and hundreds of thousands of people were dying because they couldn't get access to antiretrovirals. Foreign governments and foreign organizations stepped in to really support these activist and civil society organizations. What happened then is when we had Zuma's administration come in after a number of years of universal free access to ARVs, is we saw sort of a plateau of new infections and a reduction in the number of deaths. It's still extremely dire, the situation, in terms of how many people are dying, But these foreign entities saw the situation as improving. And so what they've decided to do is, and most of them have announced this publicly, they're looking at other places around the world and other places on the continent, saying, okay, South Africa has its situation under control now, and South Africa has to work on its own to continue trying to reduce the infection rate and reduce the number of deaths related to HIV-related causes. So instead, they're going to give their money to other countries in Africa and other countries around the world. But what's happening now is all the systems that they helped support to build up and really save lives is all of these systems and organizations are collapsing. And so we have a whole bunch of organizations, the TAC is the most prominent of them, just scrambling for survival. And we saw a company that we both know, Noah's Ark. It ended up closing because of the US PEPFAR fund was withdrawn.
And that's within the greater sort of NGO community, is that South Africa's status as a developing nation has kind of progressed as well. So a lot of the overseas funders are pulling out. But I think what really drove the point home for me was looking at a graph of Africa's biggest killers, right? And this was a story that Africa Check ran with and looked at since the latest outbreak of Ebola at the beginning of the year up until the end of September. Ebola had killed 3,500 Africans and plotted that against other diseases. And according to, I think it was 2012, World Health Organization estimates, then apportioned that and said, during that same period of time, how many people would have been killed by these other diseases? So we had 3,500 for Ebola. We had 25,000 for syphilis in the same period of time. Malaria would have killed 150,000. Lower respiratory tract infections like pneumonia, influenza would have also killed 800 and something thousand. And the biggest killer would have been HIV/AIDS with 850,000 people in the same time that Ebola had killed 3,500 people. And of those 850,000 Africans that would have died, about 200,000 of those would have been South Africans that would have died in that time, because HIV still kills about 300,000 South Africans every year, despite the efforts that, the likes of the TAC have done. So, you've got guys like Patrice Motsepe who have, been very generous and donated $1 million to the research, for finding better treatment against Ebola. But zero South Africans have died of Ebola since it's come out.
We cannot ignore the investment required into the treatment of Ebola.
Because
it could become the next major killer. So if we can nip it in the bud now, it's an investment well done.
Definitely, but it does sort of put it into perspective as to the work that still needs to be done on HIV/AIDS. Yeah. But one of the interesting things I think that the TAC faces as well, the reason they're so prominent is because they stood up against Thabo Mbeki's administration and his policies on HIV/AIDS. That's why they're so prominent. That's why we know them. They do a whole lot of other work, but that's why we know them and their famous HIV-positive T-shirts.
Yeah.
But now that also makes it more difficult for funding, because often they come up against the government. So number one, they won't take government funding unless there is no strings attached. And then I don't think they'll even take government funding even if there was an agreement that there'd be no strings attached, because there might be implied
perceptions
as to them sort of siding with government. So it makes it very, very difficult to get any sort of government funding. Number two, you're not going to get money from a guy like Patrice Motsepe because he's aligned to the ANC and has heavy ties with the African National Congress. So and the TAC is seen as somewhat of a sort of quasi opposition party, almost. And then so we have guys like that. Then other business people are also quite skeptical and quite afraid to get involved and support some of these civil society organizations that really do publicly advocate and campaign against the government. Mm-hmm. For example, the TAC right now is trying to bring down the Free State MEC of Health. Mm-hmm. They're publicly campaigning. They're trying to campaign for him to be sacked. So sometimes as well, big corporations are also scared about aligning with things like the Treatment Action Campaign because then it might influence your ability to get a government contract or something like that.
Meanwhile, don't forget the cost of HIV has on their businesses anyway. I mean, it's such a short-sighted approach within the greater context of that. It's almost time to wrap up. What we do is we canvass all our guys in the room to see what are they busy working on this week, some interesting things. Andrea, you got some interesting things working on this week, some dance, gender-based articles?
Yeah, I was interested
in gender-based articles.
Oh well, gender inequality. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking about
dance. Sorry,
gender imbalance in dance. I think that this is not explored very often, and yet is if you want, well,
because it's
you know,
the other way around.
This is serious though. I was watching a show, and you know it's very beautiful to watch, and the guy is twirling the girl around, and she's wearing very little clothing, and he's, you know, very much in the lead,
just
manipulating
be honest,
you're watching her step movements. Up too. I was just thinking it's very interesting because she's very much the centerpiece. And is that a reflection of, gender inequality in society? And to what extent in other forms of dance, perhaps, is it reversed where the woman perhaps has had more opportunity, to lead and be prominent than in other industries? And to what extent is she just sort of the trophy piece, once again, just showing that the man's in control and the woman's there to look pretty? So I think it's interesting. Yeah, to the extent that art reflects life and sometimes influences it. So, you know, away from the stage, do we still see those inequalities, and do they even matter really in dance? I think a lot of people would argue that they don't.
Although it would be frightening to see if, Disney and what they do with Frozen and things like that is actually more progressive than, you know, refined cultural arts,
I'll say,
exactly. In inverted commas.
Okay, guys, we have to wrap up. We've been given the slit throat signal from our producer, Duncan. It was great having all of you in the studio today. I'd like to thank every one of you for making it. And Chris Yellen, thank you so much for joining us today. For more information on that nuclear debate, you can go to the EE Publishers website and get some. There'll be some video as well as some articles on that. Thanks to John Stupart, editor of First Thing, Andrea Teagle, and Greg Nicholson from the Daily Maverick. I'm Stilly Sharalambos, and we look forward to hosting you next week again. Tune in on cliffcentral.com or catch the podcast on Daily Maverick or Cliff Central.